This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If you have a company that is not functioning optimally, because people are uncomfortable, because people have to be in the closet, because you know they may face discrimination, because they don't think that their company supports their values, they're not going to be producing the ideas, right, or forming the relationships that companies need today in order to thrive.
Calories and sustainability issues aside, would you eat at Chick-fil-A despite the publicly anti-gay positions of its owners? Would a corporation's discriminatory employment policies deter you from buying shares in it? Millions of Americans have changed their consumer habits based on whether they perceive corporations to be behaving in socially responsible ways. This week on Sea Change Radio, I speak with John Wilson, the head of corporate governance at Cornerstone Capital Group, about how the fight for LGBT equality has seeped into mainstream corporate America. We discuss the religious roots of the corporate social responsibility movement. We talk about how religion and progressive values are squaring off in North Carolina's civil rights battle. And we contemplate the impact of the most profitable company in the world being led by a proudly gay man. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend John Wilson. He's the head of corporate governance and engagement and research at Cornerstone Capital Group, and he's also an adjunct professor at Columbia University. John, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Alex.
So as a longtime analyst in the CSR or ESG movement, the corporate social responsibility space, why don't you give us kind of a recap of some of the touchstone issues over the last 4 or 5 decades? When did CSR become a real thing, and where are its roots?
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned roots. I think the roots of this are really with religious investors who saw this kind of investing as an extension of their own activism, right? And they would go to annual meetings and talk about the Vietnam War and automobile safety right back as early as the 60s. So this has been going on for a lot longer than people really think. And they also brought, I think, something that was very specific to their own culture, which is a spirit of reconciliation, right? They didn't want to attack these companies. They wanted to come and kind of, you know, come to a consensus about how to move forward, right? This is not break down these companies. This was, we're investors. We care about what happens to this company, and we want this company to succeed. But these issues won't go away, right? And that was really, I think, the roots of this. I think a lot of people sometimes see sustainable investing. And by the way, there's all kinds of names, values investing, socially responsible investing. They're all somehow inadequate to the task. So I use the term sustainable investing. That's just what I do, but really there's any number of names you could use for it. But for a long time, people thought that sustainable investing was all about social screening. It was basically saying, I don't want to invest in tobacco companies, or I don't want to invest in military contractors who are making landmines, or those kinds of things. And that's still out there, but there's a lot more to it than that, right? Over the last few decades, the strategy of engagement, right, going to companies, talking about these kinds of issues, has become much more prominent. And as I said, it's been around for since the early 70s or late 60s, but you know, more recently, it's become a big part of what people do when they want to have an impact on companies. Because, you know, as a shareholder, you own the company and you have leverage over what management does. Not a lot of leverage, you know, because you're usually a small investor, but some enough to get a seat at the table and really have a conversation.
Are we talking more about proxy fights in the 60s or boycotts or a combination?
Well, you know, actually, it's interesting you should mention that because, the battle over apartheid in the 1980s was a little bit of both, right? It was It was some people wanting to boycott companies that were invested in South Africa, and some people going to the companies and, yeah, using the power of the proxy, which we can talk about if you want, to, you know, get these companies to think, okay, what is the right way to be involved in South Africa, or is there a way to be ethical and be, you know, invested in a country which has institutionalized racial discrimination? And I think that a lot of the companies, upon hearing these kinds of things from investors, decided that they didn't want to be in South Africa. And that was a big part of what caused the momentous political change in the early 90s in that country. So there was a combination of a boycott strategy as well as an engagement strategy. Using the proxy, which is, you know, again, the right to vote on certain matters that come before a company, is a very important part of engagement. But another important part is really to sit down with companies and talk to them about what they're doing, about, you know, what concerns you have as an investor, and seeing what kind of changes can come about.
When you mentioned the religious backlash against some of these companies in the 60s, can you give us some examples?
Well, one good example from way back then was napalm, right? Because at this time, this was around the time that people were starting to become aware of the devastating consequences on civilian populations of the use of napalm as a weapon, right? That is, I mean, if we talk about weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, napalm certainly qualifies. And I believe it was, and I don't want to besmirch an innocent name, but I think Dow Corporation was the producer of napalm. And so these shareholders went to Dow and said, look, this is what, you know, your product is causing in this country. And is this really what, you know, what you want to be associated with? I'm not sure how effective they were. You know, at that time, this was not as kind of mainstream or accepted as it is now. But at least it gave these shareholders an opportunity to use their voice and to kind of just speak their truth to power. So that was an example of what was going on. Another one actually was, interestingly enough, General Motors on the issue of automobile safety. That was another big one. And unfortunately, I don't know how well they learned the lesson based on recent experience. But that was another thing. They would show up at meetings of General Motors, and they filed proposals, meaning all shareholders would vote, you know, about whether the company should adopt better policies regarding automobile safety. And as you know, at that time, you know, seatbelts were not standard on cars, and there was a lot of controversy about whether or not cars should have these kind of safety features that we take for granted today. So one of the ways that, you know, that shareholders had to raise these issues with companies was to go to the shareholder meetings and just talk about them, get other shareholders to vote on these issues, and as a way of getting management to, you know, at least pay attention to them, right? To have to think about it, to have to come up with an answer.
I think it's important for us to remember that the roots of the modern social responsibility movement aren't just a green movement. It's not just environmentalism. It's been strongly linked with social justice issues from the beginning.
Absolutely. And one of the most important, areas where the social investors have made a difference is in the area of what we call contract supplier standards, what some people would call sweatshops, right? And, you know, kind of in the 90s, as companies, you know, let's say apparel textile companies were outsourcing their production away from the U.S. to factories overseas, right, then people started to become aware of the working conditions that people were living under, the low wages, all of these kinds of abuses that were taking place that would never be tolerated here in the United States, right? And so you had, on the one hand, you had cheaper clothes, and you had more, you know, more options. But at the same time, the effect on the people who were actually making the clothes was not something that was acceptable to everyone. And so you had, you know, the anti-sweatshop movement on campuses, but you also had shareholders kind of showing up again and saying, hey, you know, what are we going to do about this? And the companies were at first, you know, they get very defensive and they'd say, hey, we're not making these clothes. It's not us. It's these other factories that we hired. So it's not our problem.
In other countries.
Exactly. In other countries. So what are you worried about?
It was also really different from the first anti-sweatshop movement, which was at the turn of the 20th century, where we saw the Triangle Fire, the Triangle
Right.
Building Fire. And it was kind of an offshoot of the meatpacking industry violations that Upton Sinclair exposed in the jungle.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And I actually don't think it's all that different, because a lot of the same issues that were faced in the U.S. around that time, you know, and we dealt with them through effective labor laws, unionization, those kinds of things. The same issues are, you know, were appearing in places like China, Vietnam, Indonesia, where you had child labor. You had, you know, really bad working conditions, low pay, and of course the kinds of safety issues. You know, Triangle Shirtwaist Fire was, we had similar accidents. You know, in Rana Plaza, the Zanin in Bangladesh. So you know, these kinds of things keep happening, but they happen in different places. Where the governments are not strong enough to have the kind of protections that we take for granted here, even though obviously there are shortcomings in our government as well. So the question really, you know, the reframing that had to happen for the companies was, you need to take, you know, responsibility. If your name or your swoosh or your logo is on the product, you need to take responsibility for how that product is made. You can't outsource responsibility for what happens. And eventually, I think at least in, you know, in principle, most companies accept that today. And if you see like a Nike I alluded to, or you know, even Walmart, they all have programs in place to try to address some of the issues regarding labor. And that really resulted from some of the conversations that they were having with shareholders, you know, around that time. So that's a very important social issue, and that those dialogues continue to this day, because that's a tough issue. It's not resolved by any stretch of the imagination.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to John Wilson. He's the head of corporate governance at the Cornerstone Capital Group. So the LGBT movement today has made tremendous strides, but it has been butting heads against certain offshoots of the religious communities. Maybe you can speak to that conflict and how it's informed the work that you do.
Yeah, so there is a great diversity, obviously, as you mentioned, among religious faiths on this particular issue. Among the people that I have worked with and spoken to, and the religious investors that I represented when I worked in that field, there was a consensus, though, that the discrimination is wrong. Like that really, that there's no place for discrimination in the workplace, regardless of whether we're talking about race, gender, you know, national origin, or sexual orientation, and more recently, gender identity. And that's never been, in my experience, and others may have a different experience, my experience is that there's never been a question about that. And so, you know, from the early 90s, there was a movement that was afoot, and not necessarily led by the religious investors, but generally supported by religious investors. These were more the green investors that you would be more familiar with, to get companies to adopt non-discrimination policies regarding sexual orientation and later gender identity. A lot of people, you know, now that we have same-sex marriage, you know, throughout the company enshrined in law, I think a lot of people may not be aware that LGBT people do not have the same protections everywhere regarding employment discrimination. That in some locations they do, but in others they don't. And so companies really, you know, that was a potential risk for a lot of companies, that they could end up, and in fact they had no legal reason not to discriminate against their LGBT employees or potential employees. And so starting in the 1990s, a number of these social investors started to ask companies to adopt these policies, and you know, filed shareholder resolutions asking for policies. And they took a long time. But there was it was very successful. Almost every company in the S&P 500 today, if not every company, has such a policy on their books. So it's, you know, it's the legal protections, sex, gender, national origin, etc., plus one for sexual orientation and gender identity, and that was really something that that wasn't itself driving a culture change within organizations, but help to inspire it. Because if someone was no longer afraid of being fired for coming out, that empowered them to start to just, you know, be who they were at work, start to talk about the needs of LGBT people at work. And, you know, I mean, you know how it goes, right? People, once they realize that the person sitting next to them is gay, it stops being something that they're afraid of. They realize this person is an ordinary person like everybody else. And that starts to break down barriers. And so the culture change that we've seen in corporations has really mirrored what we've seen happening really fast in society. And I think that most religious people, at least the ones that I work with, you know, applaud that, really think it's a good thing. Regardless of how they feel about the issues of, marriage and so forth, they would agree that people have a right to work.
The only wrinkle in the truth that we all live by, which is discrimination is wrong, is that the people who are advocating for these anti-LGBT laws kind of drape themselves in that same flag by saying, you need to protect our religious freedom in just the same way as you're protecting somebody who wants to get married to somebody.
Mm-hmm. And that is, I mean, I would say that's a public policy issue, really. And what we're seeing is, interestingly enough, that CEOs, and I think this is an important part of the culture change that we've been seeing, is that the CEOs of these companies are really, many of these companies are actually saying that that they're not buying those kinds of arguments, right? That religious freedom does not entail the right to discriminate against somebody else. And they're saying that this is not, you know, they're saying this not out of the goodness of their hearts, but because they believe that this is really an issue for them and for their companies. They are looking to employ people who are, you know, themselves perhaps LGBT, or they are, you know, people who really believe in equality. And so, you know, there's a war for talent out there, and the most talented people, the people who can work wherever they want, they want to work for companies that share their values. And those CEOs recognize this, and so they're, you know, there's the basic issue of saying, hey, if we're going to be, you know, operating in your location, we don't want to expose our people to discrimination. But at the same time, they want to be seen publicly, especially by their employees, as sharing their values. And that's why they've been so public about this, because it is a question of, you know, are we as a company kind of standing behind our employees and aligning themselves with their beliefs?
What does it mean for your segment of the industry when the leader of one of the largest companies in the world, Apple, comes out as gay? Tim Cook, his leadership it's been exceptional in a number of ways. What did it mean when Tim Cook came out? And maybe you could speak to the ripple effect.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very important. It's subtle, but it's important because people need to see LGBT people in positions of leadership. And Tim Cook was a well-known professional, someone, you know, a great leader, before anyone, you know, in the public at least, knew that he was gay. And so simply having that person out there, and you're right, there are very few out there, Fortune 500 companies. I mean, you know more than I do, because it's not been publicized. I think it's important because people have a model that they can look to, that this individual, whether you're an LGBT person and saying, I can reach the top rungs of the corporate ladder, that's not going to be a barrier for me necessarily, the way it might have been in the past. If you're not an LGBT person and perhaps you've never, you know, your exposure to such people is limited, or at least you think it is, this is an example of someone who, for whom this is only one part of his life, right? That the other part, he can do it as well as anyone else. So I think that these are things that are important just because of his visibility. And I think also the fact that it's Apple means that he can actually say it and not worry about any kind of backlash.
Maybe because he's so powerful and wealthy at that point.
Sometimes the reality is that the first person, you know, needs to be powerful and wealthy. He needs to be beyond reproach, right, in order to have, if you will, permission to do it. But once he's done it, then he, you know, opens up, the possibility of other people doing it as well. So I guarantee you, you know, if there are 500 companies in the S&P 500, he's not the only gay CEO. But others need to feel like they can be out and be who they are in public and not face repercussions because of it. So that's some of the importance of Tim Cook coming out. I don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice. We got to get equal rights and justice. And there'll be no crime. Equal rights and justice. There'll be no criminals. Equal rights and justice. Everyone is fighting for equal rights and justice. Palestinians fighting for equal rights and justice. Down in Angola, equal rights and justice. Down in Botswana, equal rights and justice. Down in Zimbabwe.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to John Wilson. He's the head of corporate governance at Cornerstone Capital Group. Now let's turn to North Carolina. That's a state who's recently been flirting with some very outrageous anti-LGBT laws. I just recently saw that Bruce Springsteen has pulled his concert, and there's lots of other businesses who are looking twice at whether they want to be doing business in North Carolina. The NBA is reconsidering the All-Star Game, which is scheduled to be in Charlotte. Why don't you speak about how this has evolved? If these laws had come into play 15 years ago, do you think we'd be seeing the same backlash?
I mean, I think the answer is obviously no. And, you know, we have seen, and this is, by the way, the one place where I might say I have some sympathy for the religious folks, is that this has moved so fast, you know, relative to other social movements. I think everybody has been surprised by this. That, you know, people who are accustomed to a different way of doing things may, in fact, you know, it's just really fast to make these kinds of adjustments for those folks. So I have at least, you know, that sense of a compassion for them, you know, that they've had so little time to adjust. But that having been said, you know, the laws in North Carolina, first of all, we have to understand, and this is part of the interesting thing with the shareholder campaign, is a lot of the resistance of companies to the shareholder proposals back when they were talking about the non-discrimination laws, they would talk about, well, the legal requirements, they would talk about the practical barriers to doing it. Do we need to, you know, reconfigure our bathrooms, all of these kinds of things, right? All of which kind of masked a basic prejudice about LGBT people, or I shouldn't say all of it, but certainly some of it was based upon that. And once, you know, you kind of get people thinking, let's start with the principle that everyone should be treated equally, right? And then let's talk about the practicalities of that. That was the beginning of a change in the conversation. And what's interesting, I think, about North Carolina is a lot of the same kinds of arguments are being used, right? It's about, is someone going to follow someone into a bathroom, right? Those kinds of things. But the law itself goes much further, right? The law itself prevents places like Charlotte from adopting non-discrimination policies of any kind. The argument is about, you know, the kinds of things that any, you know, you and I are both fathers of daughters, and so, you know, of course you're going to worry about the safety of your daughter. So there's an emotional appeal there, but that emotional appeal is not at all at the scope of what this law does.
And it's based in anecdotal thinking, which we always know leads to really bad policy.
Right, exactly. I mean, I don't think I'd agree with the reasoning, even if it were perfectly reflective of the law. But,
right.
But but it's not even that's not even true, right? This is Charlotte is sort of being banned from adopting the kinds of non-discrimination policies that have existed in other places for many years with nothing but good results. And so, you know, so I think that kind of shows. The intent that the framers of this law, at least, you know, the ones who are really behind it, have. And so you as a business leader are now starting to worry, okay, we have this non-discrimination policy in place. We have a philosophy of equality. We have a workforce that believes in this. For some, you know, it's going to be very important to them. And yet we're going to be putting them into a situation where they may face discrimination. And so it sort of undermines the intent of what these companies are trying to do. And so that's, I mean, and that I think is, you know, speaks to the culture change that's happening, right? So, you know, the companies had to go through this process themselves. And they were brought through this process by some very brave employees who came out and who said, you know, this is who we are. And, you know, we want to be equal at work. We want to be judged like everybody else. This is what we need to thrive in the workplace. And the more these folks are willing to come out and be themselves, the more it becomes a non-issue within companies, right? And the more, you know, top leadership starts to see, you know, that kind of, you know, attitude or mindset as being beneficial to the quality of their workforce, right? People are going to be more comfortable at work, they're happier, they're getting along better, they're going to be more engaged and more productive. And so these kinds of laws, I think, you know, strike companies today as kind of undermining all of the, you know, the benefits of their policies that they've had in place.
I'd be interested in the backlash from an investor standpoint when a company takes a stand that may be against a changing tide. For example, I'm thinking namely of Hobby Lobby, which launched that very public Supreme Court case trying to limit women's access to birth control on a religious freedom basis. Has Hobby Lobby felt that in its bottom line? And maybe you could speak to how other companies may be feeling the pinch when it comes to their stance on LGBT rights.
Where I think it could play out in the investment world is that not so much directly, because I'm not sure that investors are going to make a decision solely on this basis. But over time, if these companies are having, you know, a harder time attracting the best people or keeping them motivated because of the kinds of policies that they have, then that starts to show up in very intangible ways, but still very real.
For example?
Here's an example, right? So right now, Apple, when you think about Apple, you know, how much stuff do they own? Not very much, right? They don't have big factories. They don't have, you know, big, big heavy machinery. How do they create value? Apple creates value based on the ideas of its employees. That's it, right? The company's most important assets walk out the door at 5 o'clock, probably not five, probably like 7 or 8, but in any case, right? They walk out the door every night. And so if you have a company that is not functioning optimally because people are uncomfortable, because people have to be in the closet, because, you know, they may face discrimination, because they don't think that their company supports their values, they're not going to be producing the ideas, right, or forming the relationships that companies need today in order to thrive. And so it won't show up directly, but it may show up in just, you know, the fact that the company is just not as innovative, or because the company is not attracting the best employees, or because the company's reputation suffers as a result, and that makes it harder for them to do the kinds of things that they want to do with the employees that they want to have. So it's very difficult to say as an investor, and this is one of the challenges. If I was to make an investment decision based upon this, it would be a little hard. But I think you would see it in other ways, specifically in just the quality of the output of the company.
He's the head of corporate governance for Cornerstone Capital Group, John Wilson. John, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Eddie Harris, Crosby, Stills & Nash, and Peter Tosh. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.